welcome. So the music plays.
I finally listened to it today. It's like,
yeah, it's pretty great.
Adorable. Pretty yeah, great. I
there
love
was going to be some sexy moaning in there, but he argued with me.
Sexy moaning. Yeah, but there's nothing sexy about this like, show, so it feels misleading.
I forgot the sexy moaning, and I'm like, yeah, it probably is better that it didn't happen.
It's probably better.
Welcome to Shipwreck. I'm Casey.
I'm Amy.
And if you don't know, Shipwreck is a live show that we do once per month at the Booksmith in the Upper Haight of San Francisco. And what it consists of, Amy... What do we do?
Well, we take a book, usually something really well loved, and we assign six characters to six different writers and let them completely ruin that book by making it erotic with sex. It's gross. We make it gross.
With that said, let's talk about our inaugural episode of the live show of Shipwreck. You're going to hear it in its entirety. What book did we destroy?
Well, we picked a particularly beloved American classic. We went for Gatsby. We decided to start big.
So let's just get right to it. Which character did we first approach?
Well, we started with Gatsby. He's a war hero, he's a bootlegger, and he is miraculously a Long Islander who doesn't wear cargo shorts, and he's worth more than the whole damn bunch. And this Jay Gatsby.
This is a good point to introduce the third member of the team. It's me, it's Amy, and it's Stephen Westall, who you won't hear on the podcast because Stephen Westall's voice is the sound ringing out every one of these stories because Shipwreck is not read by the authors. It's read by our house thespian, Sir Stephen Westall. So, Sir Stephen Westall, take away this tale of Gatsby.
Jay Gatsby. In the end, Gatsby's problem was a simple one. Perhaps too simple. Simple things are often harder to see when set against a backdrop of the spectacular, like trying to find a single spider in a garden filled with roses. But it is the spiders that will hurt you in the end. Gatsby's was a garden filled with spiders, and all because of that one simple thing. No matter how many high-class whores and wild-eyed youngest daughters he brought into his bedroom, or into his hotel suites, rather, for the bedroom was reserved, ever reserved, for the glorious golden fantasy who had long since claimed her marital privileges, if only in his dreams. Jay Gatsby never learned to fuck like Old Money. Old Money could afford to purchase pussy like it was nothing. Great teeming seas of heaving breasts and open legs, each with their own mysteries to suck and sample. Old Money could try every perversion and permutation of the sexual world before most men could dream of more than a trip to the carnival coochie show. For a woman whose best days were further behind her than an old farm horse might pull up her sequin skirt a little too high, granting them a glimpse of the mysteries that lay tucked and dreaming twixt her thighs. Old Money could buy the carnival. Buy the coochie show, buy the broken down old dancing girls, if it saw the need. Old Money had no need for mystery, for poetry, for anything but prizing wide the legs of the world and ramming itself balls deep into dark and hidden places. Old Money was carnal, cruel, jaded, capable of almost anything, while genuinely concerned with almost nothing. Gatsby learned this the first time he traded one of those top-flight call girls for a doe-eyed dame with legs like Road to Heaven and a cunt like the Promised Land. He expected their bodies to come together in erotic verse, his hands and lips and cock writing the depth of his love for Daisy on the body of a nameless stand-in, whose pleasures he would pursue almost as an apology for what was fucking without love. Instead, he had been ridden hard as a jalopy, pressed broken and sweating into the sheets while the force of nature he had invited into his bed worked through her anger at her father, at society, at the world. She'd kissed his cheeks before she left him, told him he was sweet, and slipped, still nameless, out the door while his prick lay quivering against his thigh, coated in the smell of her. The fucking of old money, he had quickly decided, would take more effort to master. So it was more expensive whores. So it was more dissatisfied daughters and the occasional dissatisfied wife. A rarer and more dangerous beast to bridle, what with the risk of husbands coming home, and most of them had gone so long without a proper fucking that they welcomed him with open arms. So it was more cheap in personal trysts and closets and in cloak rooms, and once, while the champagne had flowed particularly easy and the night had grown spectacularly late, in the back seat of a stranger's car. Lacy undergarments, rumpled curls, and a dozen, 2 dozen, 100 beautiful cunts, all blurred together in the faint taste of salt and bruises on his hips. And still, for all of that, he came to their beds eager and alert, watched their moves, desperate to please them and to be pleased in return. If Jay Gatsby had been a soldier before he found his fortune, his cock was a soldier still. Surmounting beachhead after beachhead, maidenhead after maidenhead, in search of that perfect degree of jaded detachment. New money fucked like sex was still something precious and rare and difficult to come by. The tendency of Jay Gatsby to put the pleasure of his partners before his own was whispered through certain secret channels. Until he found himself surrounded by flocks of hopefully smiling girls in fringe and sequins, their jaded eyes bright with the thought of tasting and being tasted by something new. He was kind to all of them, because kindness was a part of the persona he had so carefully constructed, and he thought he kept them at a pleasant distance, even when they had their legs wrapped around his waist and their fingers buried in his hair. He was detached, cool, untouchable. He told himself that, and kept telling himself that, and no one believed him, least of all the girls who left him bruised and aching on the floor. Gatsby cared too much to ever understand the world that he had chosen, that had never chosen him. When Daisy finally came to him, pale and perfect and trembling, he thought the world was finally setting itself right, that at long last the story he had been composing for years was beginning to be told. He fell upon her with all the lessons he had learned from his nameless girls, but ah, this was no hired harlot. This was no bored and bloodless heiress. This was Daisy. His Daisy. And when she spread her legs for him, his heart stopped. Just like it had on that long-gone North Dakota day when the lady at the carnival coochie tent had taken his order and shown him her secret, hidden labyrinth of pleasures. How could he be detached? She was everything he had ever wanted and more, and she wanted him, and all he cared about was pleasing her as a woman should be pleased. His tongue was Theseus in search of the Minotaur. And when he found the hard knot of its lair at the top of her cunt, he bore down until she moaned like Adrienne in the dark. When she left him come morning, her dress clutched around her and her knees still weak, he knew that she had been most thoroughly and sincerely fucked. And that in the end, and that in the end, was his undoing. For there is no hiding such sincerity in a world of pasteboard and facade. A man may change many things, his name, his standing, the cut and fabric of his shirt, but he cannot change the nature of his prick, or the memory of a carnival dame with her skirt hiked and her eyes shadowed by the ghosts of the sweet young girl she once had been. Jay Gatsby fucked with sincerity. He fucked like new money, like every lay was precious and not his due. Perhaps if he had learned to do differently, he would have fucked for longer. But not perhaps with half so much brilliance. Thank you.
Shauna McGuire, also known as Mira Grant, wrote that Gatsby pion? We can call it a pion.
I think we can. Okay, so our next Gatsby character is a symbol of the American dream. Not the parties, not the green light, not Daisy, not even Myrtle's affair with Tom. The other symbol of the American dream. Gatsby's yellow Rolls Royce.
The yellow car. The love of the last tight poon. Once again, to Zelda. In my younger and more vulnerable years, my father gave me some sweet, sweet lovin' that I've been turning over in my mind ever since. Whenever you feel like boning anyone, he told me, just remember that all the people in the world haven't had all the great mouth fun that you have. He didn't say more, but we've always been unusually communicative in a reserved way. At 9 o'clock one morning in late July, Gatsby's gorgeous car lurched up the rocky drive to my door, and I gave a burst of melody, and gave out a burst of melody from its three-note horn. It was the first time he had called on me. Though I had gone to two of his parties, been mounted in his hydroplane, and, at his urgent invitation, made frequent use of his anus. He saw me looking with admiration at his D. It's pretty. It's pretty, isn't it, old sport? He jerked off to give me a better view. Haven't you seen it before? I'd seen it. Everybody had seen it. It was a rich cream color, bright with nickel, swollen here and there in its monstrous length. I had bumped him perhaps 6 times in the past month, and found, to my disappointment, that he had very little to splooge. So my first impression, that he was a person of some identified jizzitude, had gradually faded, and he became simply the proprietor of an elaborate boner next door. And then came that disconcerting mustache ride. We hadn't reached Breast Egg Village before Gatsby began leaving his elegant ejaculations unfinished and slapping himself indecisively in the grundle. He wouldn't say another word. His horriness grew on him as we neared the city. We passed Port Roosevelt, where there was a glimpse of a big-tittied, ocean-going babe, and sped along the cobbled slum lined with the bald, wet snatches of the faded, gilt 1900s. Then, the Valley of the Gashes opened out on both sides of us, and I had a glimpse of Mrs. Wilson straining at Tom's pump with panting vitality as we went by. With booties spread like wings, we scattered light through Astoria. As we twisted among the elevated, I heard the familiar jump, jump, splat of someone performing a supreme Houdini. But instead, it was just a frantic policeman riding up. All right, old sport, called Gatsby. We slowed down. Taking a huge giant wang from his pocket, he waved it before the man's eyes. Right you are, agreed the policeman, tipping his cap. Know you next time, Mr. Gatsby. Excuse me. What was that you just pulled out of your trousers, I inquired. A fellow Oxford man? I was able to do the commissioner a favor once. The supreme Houdini, to be exact. And now he sends me a Christmas card every year. A MILF hunter passed us in a bang bus, deep twin bosoms, followed by 2 carriages with drawn blinds, and by a more cheerful carriage for friends. Sisters hot friends, bussy friends of wives, hot girlfriends of dads. The friends looked out at us with tragic eye and supple upper lips of southeastern Miami. Or perhaps Brazil. And I was glad at the sight of Gatsby's humongous rod. Was included in the VIP. As we crossed Blackwell's Island, a limousine passed us, driven by a white reality king, in which sat 2 modish bang bros and a naughty bookworm. I laughed aloud as the yolks of their eyeballs rolled towards us in haughtily ribaldry. Anything can happen now that we've slid over this bridge, I thought. Anything at all. So we beat off, bumps against the current, going back ceaselessly into my ass.
And if you're just now coming to Shipwreck for the first time, then you probably read a quote from the author of that as regards the content of Shipwreck, which is that it's deplorable and grotesque. That is Nate Wagoner, the corner lad of Right Club San Francisco. He's also done a lot of other great stuff, but we don't only really care about that.
Next up, the golfer with a fast reputation, who is definitely not a representation of women's lib, Jordan Baker.
Jordan Baker. After the fiasco with Nick Carraway and the rest of those assholes, Jordan Baker decided she was done with Eastern men. Even those who managed, by way of chilling prose, to masquerade as Westerners. With East and West eliminated, she was left only with North and South, and had the good sense not to go to Canada, where no one wrote anything worthwhile. In her little egg-shaped world, it seemed that people died by accident too often, and she wanted a place where people died more purposefully, or else lived on indefinitely and complained a lot about it. From Mick, she had learned that men who were verbose and relatively coherent could only be trouble. So she sought out a man who would be verbose and incoherent. She went to Mississippi and made the acquaintance of Quentin Compson. Jordan knew right away that Quentin was deep, sensitive, and boasted a great literary significance because she could make sense of nothing he said. Sometimes he managed to come close. "You look nice today, Jordan," he would begin. But then, before she could politely thank him, his eyes would go wild, and he would say something to the effect of, "Dalton Ames! Dalton Ames! Father, I have committed incest, Father!" It was very disconcerting. Unfortunately, his literary significance did not stop him from being a disappointing lover. "Gosh, Quentin," she said, "I knew you Faulkner characters had trouble with narrative thrust, but..." He stared dolefully at the clock on the wall. "Are you even listening to me?" Jordan was not used to being ignored. "Hey," she said, "I heard your family owns a golf course." "No," he shook his head. "We just live next to one, and my brother likes to..." "Dalton Ames! Dalton Ames!" scream and scare the golfers. "Oh, well, that's sort of the same." It wasn't the same. But Jordan was known for her incurable dishonesty and didn't think the lie mattered much if it would get him to do something. He didn't. His eyes roved back to the clock. He was beginning to irritate her. "Oh, what's so goddamn interesting about that clock?" "It's not a clock. It's a mausoleum of all hope and desire, used to gain the reducto absurdum of all human experience." "Quentin, I have no patience for this." Indeed, she was losing patience for all men, but she thought he might be too fragile to hear that. On top of his interest in incest and time, he also possessed a fatalistic impulse, and she didn't want to be responsible for him jumping off a bridge and drowning in the odor of honeysuckle. She'd really just been hoping for a quick screw and a few swings on the cool Confederate golf course, but he didn't seem to be capable of giving her either. Christ, was there anyone up in Canada? Maybe Dudley Do-Right. He had to be better than those effete Easterners and delicate, tormented Southerners, even if Rocky and Bullwinkle had been wrongfully excluded from the Western literary canon. "Quentin," she said irritably, "you're boring me." Jordan hated to be bored. "I'm starting to feel that this is a waste of time." His eyes widened at the word time. "Oh, for fuck's sake, if you don't do something amusing soon, I'm gonna smash that clock." "Good," he said in a long southern drawl. "Clocks slay time. Time is dead as long as it's being clicked off by little wheels. Only when the clock stops does time come to life. She groaned, and not in the way she'd been hoping to groan for herself. The past isn't dead, he told her wistfully. It's not even past. Oh, God. She sprang up from the bed and began dressing herself, putting on one of the golf outfits it was now clear she would not get to use. Do you want to know something? All you tormented male literary heroes are the same. Such fucking melodrama and self-absorption. Do you ever hear a woman bitching like that in a book? No! No one writes books about us because we're too badass and likable. Just take a look at your sister. Father, I have committed incest. Father, I... Shut up! She snapped. If this, she gestured vaguely around the room, is indicative of your prowess, then you definitely didn't commit incest or anything else. Okay, I made it up. Well, that's somewhat admirable, but you're still a whiner. He shrugged. God, didn't this asshole know who she was? I know I'm utterly fascinating, she continued, but I have a sense of decorum. I had the decency to sit on the sidelines and look sporty and tan when my insight was not necessary to advance the story. Advance the story, he said? Yes, Quentin, some stories actually move. Oh. He seemed to be struggling with this, his forehead creased. But, she raised her eyebrows meaningfully in his direction, it's abundantly clear that nothing is moving tonight, so I'll be on my way. And so Jordan Baker beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the west. She came to San Francisco, which seemed like a good place for women who were seriously fed up with men. Once there, she enlisted the help of a fellow sportswoman, a dykey ex-softball player named Samantha, and opened a bar called Queers, where everyone knows you're gay. And is always glad you came. In every sense of the word. Everything was beautiful, homosexual, linear, unpretentious, and nothing hurt.
That was Jordan Baker by our very first Tumblr contest winner.
Tumblr contest winner. We solicited writers on Tumblr, and she was pretty amazing.
You'd be surprised. There apparently people write fan fiction on Tumblr. Who knew?
Who knew?
J.S. Bourget is the name of that author, which is surely a God-given name. All right, and that's the third. That means we're halfway through the show. This is a good time to stop and say that Shipwreck is a presentation of Booksmith and Write Club San Francisco. It happens once a month.
You can like us on Facebook. We're at Shipwreck SF.
And you can just find us. You can search for us. You should like us on Facebook.
You should tweet about us, too. And use the hashtag ShipwreckSF, because if you use the hashtag Shipwreck, you will be in a conversation about actual shipwrecks.
Kind of a drag.
So coming back from the half, we have the self-described non-judgmental narrator who walks around judging literally every other character in the entire book, Nick Carraway.
Does he actually say he's non-judgmental?
He does. He just...
Slower. Slower.
Nick Carraway. He reached down and pulled out the enigmatic wonder of his smooth and clean-shaved testicles. Each one resembling a darkened poached egg from which a lingering smell of pickles, growing sweat, and cheese wafted up, causing me to salivate and moan. I did not mean to moan, but for all my ability to remain aloof, I cannot contain myself. My eyes roll back, and I faint. When I regain my senses, I am unable to move beneath my dear Gatsby's surprisingly profuse gut, so well hidden behind his usual fine jacket and vest. Gatsby is, in fact, flabby. But regardless, the world ends briefly in this moment. I, smothered by a wealthy millionaire, he collapsed upon a bisexual, incest-loving, sardonic bondsman. And after a few seconds of rapid blinking, Gatsby's face hovers over me. His lips tremble as he places his soft fingers to my hair, my neck, trails his fingers down to my ass, and he calls my name with the urgency of someone calling another off a balcony, off a ledge, off a bridge. Nick! Nick! Oh, Nick! I'm bad! I've been such a bad, bad little boy! I was not ashamed of his sex talk until a small dog came close to the door, peering through the glass into the sitting room, and sat watching diligently as I and the great Gatsby fucked as only gentlemen can. On the ground, slacks and boxers loosed around the ankles, sock garters high on the calves, and hair pomade from our heads generously gathered around my buttocks. The dog, unblinking and unforgiving, seemed to say, "Nick, old chap, what's happening?" I had no reply. I moved my arms about as if shooing away a fly, but the dog sat unflinching. It seemed determined to stare, to be a voyeur. Eye locked, we remained still until it begins to yelp, as only small dogs can, high-pitched and relentless. It even began licking itself, barking, and then licking, and then more avidly bites into its little, and then more avidly bites into its little groin as Gatsby increases his pace behind me. No matter how hard or fast, I could not focus on Gatsby in the least. And we stop and resume outside into the ambiguity of the night. And we do. At the beach, he reaches down and pulls out once again his smooth balls. And I am both hungry and aroused, and again could not contain myself, and came prematurely in my pants. And again my eyes roll back, and again I faint. And after a few seconds, I'm awake. Gatsby stands upright and flicks the sand lodged between his balls and his anus, and slaps my bare back as if congratulating me on a good game of tennis. Good try, old sport. With almost all his clothes on, he offers his bejeweled hand to help me up. His every nail is manicure and smooth, his palms lotioned so softly. I instantly imagine the supple but firm penis that would be gloved by such a velvety grip, and accepted the gesture. We were, after all, more than men. But the quiet roar of the ocean, great whales dancing, the sexing of water into the dark night, the sound of buttocks and balls slapping like the crashing shore around us, the thrashing and undulating slipperiness of a thousand and thousands of phallic sea anemone reaching towards the surface of the sky. This was love, and I wanted more, and could not stop touching myself. We try again, and this time I can feel Gatsby's testicles. Their light knocking against the inner thigh tickles as it taps incessantly, like impatient fingers. I could not tell the difference between him and Daisy for a brief moment, and almost call out her name. Gatsby's staccato engulfment of my anus and Daisy's strap-on dildo were one. If not for Gatsby's dainty balls beating lightly upon my skin. Gatsby's hips and hands were so like Daisy's, so familiar. I could almost picture it now, one summer vacation home from Yale, visiting Daisy in the garden. She had asked if I still remembered her, and I did. She placed her hand over my eyes, that delightful girl. And before I could ask further, she undid my belt and yanked my pants down with her other hand, and to my great surprise, managed to insert her new dildo with a sore and hard push and giggled. But more so, I remember her delicate thin hands around her new toy. Her hands were so smooth, so refined, like Gatsby's hands were now placed in mind. And the garden suddenly merges into the beachside. The past and the present and time became singular. I could not tell you what happened next, other than I involuntarily whispered Daisy's name aloud into Gatsby's ear. And abruptly, Gatsby's body stiffened, and he coils away from me. I put on my clothes and find myself suddenly cold and more flaccid than I had ever been. Gatsby returns to the glow of his party, his outline growing smaller, sinks into the brightness. I follow him as one follows a broken heart, regrettably. And tragedy, my silk boxers are ruined, and I'm no longer hungry. And with each step towards the spectacle of affluence and glittering excess of millionaires, I become more consumed by thoughts of how I could apologize. Undo the damage. I could send him hair pomade. And attach a love note that reads, "This is as much for you as it is for me." I continue to fantasize chance encounters near the bathroom, among his hand towels and miniature soaps and gilded faucets, grinding along on his tailored suits and shimmering ascots. Or in the pool, yes, the pool, which was so like the ocean, and maybe I could swim naked in elaborate backstroke with my penis floating left and right, waving to him. I continue thinking of the pool and how the dramatics of the world required much maintenance, much plotting, and I was no exception. At some point, Jordan finds me engulfed in the view of the ocean from the balcony. She smiles as she hands me a flute of champagne and asks, "Finally having a gay time, are we?" And I was. Certainly. With thoughts of Gatsby, I felt every pubic hair stand straight up, heightened by the mere mention of his name. Indeed, I say. The future seemed orgasmic and stretched out like refractions of light from a place that could never be touched or held. And immediately, I asked for more champagne. Endless champagne.
That's Nick Carraway, as imagined in his most sexual capacity by Carolyn Ho. So, there you have it.
Carolyn Ho, the fabulous Booksmith employee.
That's all you are to
the erotic poet who was actually a star. Did you see her McDonald's commercial?
No.
She was in McDonald's commercials in the 80s.
So, if I'm not mistaken, the next performance is based around a sign of some sort?
Yes. It's the judge...
Judge, jury, and execution.
It's the jazz age's judgiest billboard. Dr. T.J. Eckelberg.
Do it one more time.
It's the jazz age's judgiest billboard. Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. Oh.
Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. His eyes were weary. Bored, even. Eckelberg was so utterly done with presiding constantly over the endless debauchery of the jazz age as the sun melted into West Day. Another lonely, dusty night in the valley. This is long after the Gatsby man was shot dead and all that terrible, hideous drama happened there on the Ashy Road. Eckelberg had been so appalled by all that, so sickened, but what could he do? He was merely a billboard with a pair of steel moon-shaped glasses affixed, permanently austere. The long, taut steel legs beneath him would not move, or he did not have any knees to walk with. He was a prisoner of his own form. Maybe if he hadn't been so tragically immobile, he could have toddled up to that lightning yellow car, that dastardly villainous murderer. How thrilling it would be to climb inside its evil interior, speeding over the bridge back to New York together, a couple of old sports out on the town looking for some hoot and mischief. Maybe at the end of a long night of dancing, of Charleston and moonshine, they would perhaps have fallen knit into one another in some bedroom or other, on lush red velvet and entwined in one another, hit peaks of ecstasy Eckelberg could only dream of. The yellow car would have tenderly nudged the steel glasses from the doctor's naked face. It would have smoothly fingered the rims of them and then placed them on the dresser beside them, only to look him deep into his all-seeing eyes. What things have you seen, TJ? Thomas James. Doctor. Doctor. The car would rumble, all engine and light and empathy. TJ knew the car had to have a heart under its cool steel exterior. It had to have empathy, despite it having the relentless wheels of a murderer. He imagined collapsing under its weight in throes of mechanical passion, and it places in the ash where his heart would have been. Something moved with the wind. Eckelberg did not sigh, for he did not have lungs. He did not ball his fists in his eye sockets in despair and frustration, for he did not have any fists. Though he was utterly full of despair and frustration. These new money, old money dickbags, he thought to himself, with their bodies and limbs and mouths and hearts, his loneliness was unrivaled. He was perpetually outside, looking outside or inside, within, without, within, nothing, without a body, without a heart. Though New York sparkled, its distant debauchery like a row of lit firecrackers, Eckelberg looked up, up, to the huge, deep sky, pockmarked with tiny diamond stars. This, for him, was what made it all worthwhile. All day he would watch sweaty men dig roads. All evening he would eavesdrop parties or peep at affairs. And when everything was still, all the fleshy creatures of the city finally out of his line of absolutely impeccable and almost supernatural sight, he gazed up. The moon hung like a dollar coin over the horizon of this glistening, throbbing city. The peace was broken, then, by something Eckelberg had never seen before. A form moving through the sky, silver, almost like a star or a comet, but bigger, more beautiful. This great miracle sailed along the horizon and crept nearer and nearer until he could see all of its delicate curves, the low swoop of a hull beneath a majestic disc of its body. Eckelberg looked closer. What was this angelic wonder called? It was closer by now, not at all close enough to even skirt the ridge of his board, but close enough for him to read what appeared to be a saucy tattoo on the silver angel's side. USS Enterprise. NCC-1701. USS! That must mean a sailor. Eckelberg, how delightful. Not only this, but a star sailor. What a wonderful thing to cruise through the night sky. What things he could see from there, he fancied. Everything, maybe even the entire world. How Eckelberg envied this beautiful angel and again cursed his useless form. This great ship, as though somehow intercepting his loneliness, suddenly shot a strip of gleaming white down from its hull, which penetrated the bleak darkness of the Valley of the Ashes, illuminating everything so suddenly. Eckelberg was damn near blinded, but didn't have time to think. He was moving. Up, he went into the soft metallic folds of the Enterprise, his billboard legs unearthed from the asphalt below him. The night sky was suddenly a dance floor, and all of New York spread itself open before him, and it was a glorious, gorgeous thing, only more gorgeous, for Eckelberg knew he would never have clasped his eyes upon it at all, if the bastard upon it all, and it's all, and all its bastard debutantes ever again. He was just him, and this ship, this voyager from above, it was his ship now, he thought to himself, as the steel of it took him inside of itself and consumed him entirely, about to bring him where no man... Show him that he didn't have to always be without. Finally taking him tenderly, sweetly, within.
And that was T.J. Eckelberg as envisioned Sarah Griffin, who's got a new book called
Not Lost.
I was going to say Almost Home.
Almost Home, Not Lost. Whatever.
I feel like the next book's got to be called Almost Home, right?
Yes. Not Lost, Almost Home.
And we're going to close this whole thing out with an anonymous posting.
Yeah. Our next character, she was the original Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Daisy Buchanan.
Daisy Buchanan. The grander... Logan. Title. Even the most painful memories lose their edge eventually. Perhaps that explained why, barely 3 years after the unpleasantness in West Egg, Tom and I found ourselves at the most lavish party Manhattan had ever seen before or since. My dear host lost Jay Gatsby's party. Oh, my dear lost... Jay Gatsby's parties were extravagant, but Mr. Logan's parties were rumored not only their equal, they were in Manhattan, ergo they actually meant something. The top 5 floors of the plaza sprouted acrobats from the rafters, Ellingtons and Callaways from its stages, and socialites from its dance floors. The topmost floor housed exclusively gilded quarters from which trickled down only the most hushed of whispers. I insisted on meeting our mysterious host. Several lovely, perfect strangers pointed me towards him. He stood on the balcony, staring down Central Park as if it were prey for him to master. The way his British nose actively scented the air suggested that it was. "Charming party," I sang to his arched back. I saw his nostrils flare briefly. He did not turn around. "We haven't met. I'm Mrs. Daisy Days," he growled. Only one man ever called me by that nickname. He turned to me. My height, or perhaps shorter, resplendent in a white silk tuxedo that creased as if he'd spent more time crouching than standing. Feral black scruff poked from his shirt collar and cuffs, barely more man than animal. My head swam with recognition and sudden, desperate longing. James? James Wolfe? But it's Mr. Logan now. And you're Mrs. Buchanan, yes, of the Chicago Buchanan. He snorted, raising a bushy eyebrow. "You don't smell married." He knew, even before I did. Like a tiger that knows when his mates take heat, my loins flamed like a Roman candle in a bonfire. "Come with me," he growled. He brushed past me into the ballroom. I followed like a lost child going home. Pursuing him across that magnificent expanse, I recalled my heady debutante days in Louisville. Barely weeks after bidding adieu to darling Gatsby, I met Private James Wolfe, United States Marine Corps, in our overflow medical center, suffering severe head trauma from fighting overseas. He had lost his memory. I sought to bring new worlds to this weaken tabula rasa of a man and provide comfort. I called him my little wolf marine. As his strength returned, the more comfort I provided. Our heated couplings threatened to melt the Kentucky winter. The party's blare cut sharply as Logan closed the door behind us. He dragged me past connected suites, housing a host of randy celebrity debaucheries. I saw Babe Ruth interfere with Mary Pickford as a slobbering bulldog might mount a sparrow. Nearby, a dusky Josephine Baker strangled Al Jolson with a bullwhip. On the divan, heavyweight Jack Dempsey used his famous fists on a gaily humming Fatty Arbuckle in a way I would have thought, if not impossible, at least painful. Logan pulled me up a grimy flight of stairs, and I remember his hands, savage vices, sporting curious ridges of hard bone just above his knuckles. One of his uglier aspects that drove me wild. We emerged alone to the brisk air of the plaza's 20-story roof. Lights twinkled about us. It was as if Logan had pulled the stars to our level. "That's better," he said with some relief. "Quieter." "Logan, why all this?" I asked. "And please, don't say it's to impress me. I don't think I can handle that again." "Days. You gotta understand, I forgot all about you." "Flatterer." "I ain't kidding. After Louisville, I went back to Europe as a soldier of fortune. Me and that bastard Victor Creed who fought the Battle of Brittany. We did our job. But I took a Mauser round to the head." He pointed to an unblemished spot on his forehead where a bullet could not exist on any living being. "Made me forget everything all over again, damn it. Had to build a new life. But your scent, just now, Days, it brought everything back. I'm whole again. Don't you see? The memories I make with you, they're indelible." I felt faint. "You ready to make some more memories, Days?" Was I ever. Even his kisses were rough. Leathery lips buffeted my own mouth, clearing way for a probing tongue so fervid it practically scalded my own. His hands clawed at my expensive drop-waist Chanel. I pushed Logan away and leaned back against a chimney, spreading my thighs ever so. Hint taken, he dropped to his knees. Thank the fates for step-out bloomers. Ducking his hirsute head under my dress, he set to giving my orchid a masterful tending. He approached it as a curious kitten might, dabbing playfully with his nose and testing me with the tip of his tongue. Then he brought his fingers into play, caressing my flowers' engorged petals with gentle but knowing insistence. It was in this that Logan held sway over me in a way no other man could. He was truly the best at what he did. And what he did was ever so nice. I grabbed the two cowlicks of dark hair that perked up above his ears like some predator's horns and pulled them towards me, mashing his rough countenance harder against my blazing garden. It brought a shudder that I feared would shake my form apart. "Logan!" I gasped, finishing to the sounds of the city. "I'm not likely to forget that, darling." I turned towards the chimney, hiked my Chanel, and looked back with the slyest of smirks, offered him his choice of new memories. He returned my smile and undid his cummerbund. It unbuckled with a loud crack. That crack seemed to undo a spigot in his forehead. I screamed before I even saw the bullet hole, another second before Logan collapsed to the ground. Suddenly, a hulking figure stepped from the shadows to fill the space Logan had fallen from. A beast in a filthy overcoat, every grinning tooth filled to the gristly saber. That's enough screaming for one night, don't you think, girly? I recognized him from Logan's descriptions. It was Victor Creed, Logan's fellow soldier of fortune. Sorry to shoot your boyfriend in the head. He gestured with his smoking Luger. But I need him for another job overseas, and I'd just as soon not have to tie him down. Besides, how much do you really know about him? That he can't be killed? Stab him! Shoot him! It all grows back. Except memories. And let's not forget these. He mashed his foot on Logan's right hand and twisted it. With a wet sound, 3 2-foot claws popped through the bony ridges above Logan's knuckles, glistening with blood. He was more animal than I ever knew. Betcha your little wolf marine never used those in the boudoir, he snorted. Why don't you go home with your husband and forget this? I stumbled, terrified, through the party like a madwoman before collapsing into Tom's arms. I never ventured east of the Mississippi again. Logan and I both strove for memory, he to recapture old ones, and I to erase mine. In that, we both failed. I would always remember that night on the roof of the plaza, and he, my beloved Wolf Marine, would never be lost.
And that was Daisy Buchanan. I can't tell you who wrote the piece, but you can tell us which piece you thought was best. Our audience already decided on a winner, but maybe you disagree. Let us know on Twitter. Use the hashtag ShipwreckSF. Or on Facebook. You can find us. Just we're just Shipwreck there.
No, we're ShipwreckSF there.
Really? We're planning a big empire.
Well, there was no... Shipwreck was taken.
Obviously. Yeah, well, we also are planning a big empire.
We're also planning a big empire.
If you're looking to run a shipwreck in your town, get in touch with us or we will shut you down with every... power the law has to offer. For more, you know, more, come see the show.
Yeah, we're every month, first Thursday, over at Booksmith in the Haight, 1644 Haight Street. You can go to booksmith.com for more details.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This is the most awkward
Bye
podcast
forever.
Ever. See ya.